Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Young Turks. Cenk Uygur still out, will be out for a long time, but we'll keep saying it at the beginning of each show, just so you know. I'm Johnny Derola, and I'm joined by Anna Kasparian, yet again, joining me in the first hour, leading the second hour. Mm-hmm. And Ambry Allen is also joining us in the first hour. I've never actually done the show with you.
I know, this is a first time for us.
Usually so. I'm walking out and you're walking in. So I didn't know some of your background. You're a doctoral candidate of sociology at UCLA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to give you some advice.
Please, probably should have been don't enter the program.
But no.
A couple years too late.
You're sticking with it, so you can give me advice. If you don't finish your doctorate,
yes,
don't let Cenk or Jimmy find out about it because they'll never let you live it down.
Oh, has this happened
That's
to
actually
you?
Very
yeah,
true.
Yeah. Okay. I pulled out to work here, and they mocked me to this day. But you're also, so I knew that you did TV.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you did stand up.
I do.
And you have you have a tour coming up.
Well, so I was on tour with Kim Whitley and David Arnold. They have a He Said, She Said tour, so that goes on. And then I perform in LA, so check me out.
In
Twitter.
LA?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram, and I post when my shows are, so yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. So on today's episode of The Young Turks, we have a lot. We have, realistically, too much. Look at these papers, come on, we got way too much. Because the grilling of the intelligence chiefs has been going on. Revelations about Comey, you know, his testimony was leaked. A bit of a spoiler alert he should have given. So we're gonna cover that, but we've also got the feud between Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions. We've got an update on the special election in Georgia. We've got kids' cancer charities and the people who are profiting off of them. You might recognize some of the names. And finally, some justice for Kansas as well. So a lot to get to. We should probably jump into it. But before we get to that news, I did want to mention something. In the past 24 hours, Iran was the target of a particularly devastating terror attack. A group of both gunmen and suicide bombers stormed Iran's parliament building, which is to some extent shut down right now because of concerns about security and the upgrades necessary for it. Apparently, they were onto something there. But tragically, at least 12 are dead, both from a combination of suicide bombers and the gunmen. At the same time that the parliament building was the target of this terror attack, you also had the mausoleum holding the body of the sort of spiritual leader of the Iranian revolution also being attacked, another person dying there. And, you know, we hear about terror attacks every day, you know, because the world is in a terrible spot. But Iran itself is not necessarily the constant target of acts of terror. And so, you know, obviously our sympathies go out to them. I did want to read, though, a statement that was put out by the White House, which has its good side and it has its bad side. The beginning is, we grieve and pray for the innocent victims of the terrorist attacks in Iran. There's no graphics for this. And for the Iranian people who are going through such challenging times. That's good, but then it goes on to say, we underscore that states that sponsor terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote. Which sounds to me like blaming the victim there.
Well, I mean, there have been a number of countries that do not promote terrorism that have been attacked by terrorists. So that's a weird line of thinking.
Yeah, and unnecessary. And that is the common narrative coming out of the White House, is that you cannot simply stand in solidarity. You cannot simply express grief. There always has to be some sort of little cut.
Sure. I mean, it was a jab in the middle of a statement that's supposed to show that you sympathize with all the people that are hurting right now.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know.
And this is the second time, I think, this week that that's happened. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then times when we want them to actually make a statement about something, they have nothing to say. So,
yeah, like the Portland attacks that left two dead, Trump. Just not interested in it. I guess they didn't talk about it on Fox and Friends. So he didn't talk about it. Now, ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attacks. But the statement coming out of Iran's foreign minister, at least, seems, without specifying, seems to implicate Saudi Arabia. They believe that Saudi Arabia might have had some hand in this. That is what the foreign minister is saying. I'm simply passing it on to you. But obviously, a devastating terror attack, and our thoughts go out to the victims. But let's move on to some domestic news. Just a day before James Comey's much anticipated testimony, the heads of two US intelligence agencies all throughout the day have been grilled by the Senate Intelligence Committee. And we've learned a little bit, but there's also a lot that those individuals have not been willing to say. We've got many instances of this. We do want to show you some of them. So you're gonna see some of the frustration immediately on the face of some of these senators, for the most part Democrats, but Marco Rubio also attempted in ways to get some real answers. So the fundamental question is, did Donald Trump intervene in some fashion to try to either stop Comey or the investigation into Russia and the election more generally? And so here is the beginning of that.
Director Coates, you've said as well that it would be inappropriate to answer a simple question about whether the president asked for your assistance in blunting the Russia investigation. I don't care how you felt. I'm not asking whether you felt pressured. I'm simply asking, did that conversation occur?
And once again, Senator, I will say that I do believe it's inappropriate for me to discuss that in an open session.
You realize, and obviously this is not releasing any classified information, but you realize how simple it would simply be to say, no, that never happened.
And so he's going to continue trying to get this guy to go on the record. You're going to see that in this clip.
Why is it inappropriate, Director Coates?
I think conversations between the president and myself are, for the most part.
You seem to apply that standard selectively.
No, I'm not applying it selectively. I'm just saying I don't think it's appropriate.
You clear an awful lot up by simply saying that never happened.
I do not share with the general public conversations that I have with the president or many of my colleagues within the administration that I believe are should not be shared.
Well, I think your unwillingness to answer a very basic question speaks volumes.
It's not a matter of unwillingness,
Mr. Rosen.
It's a matter of how I share it and whom I share it to. And when there are ongoing investigations, I think it's inappropriate to.
So you don't think the American people deserve to know the answer to that question?
I think the investigations will determine that.
I mean, that hearing is part of the investigation, one would think. And yeah, general public, I get that that means something. It is a group of senators who are trying to find out. I mean, oversight is so difficult with this White House. We have a White House lawyer saying, as a matter of policy, do not cooperate with any Democratic senatorial or congressional attempts at oversight, requisitions of information and things like that. And so a little bit of help would be nice from the DNI and other intelligence heads.
I wonder if he's trying to play it in a way where if he doesn't confirm it, he won't deal with any type of retaliation from the Trump administration. But if he denies it, I mean, he's lying. So he could face ramifications for that should the investigation find that Trump was trying to, you know, meddle with the investigation and you know, was guilty of obstruction of justice. I don't know if it was a smart strategy, but either way, it seems like you're hiding something, dude. Mm-hmm. You know, and that doesn't look good.
Absolutely. And I think if there is fear of retaliation from the White House, then that also should be a public concern.
Right.
That folks can't speak out and tell the truth for fear of retaliation from our White House. And I also think him saying that he doesn't want to share something with the general public, well, you kind of answer to the general public, right? Mm-hmm. Like you answer to us. So
exactly.
If that was the case, then this shouldn't be public. It's kind of like, why are you here?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they're there because they're required to be. I'm sure. Yeah. They don't want to.
Sure.
And yeah, the thing about that, whenever you did X conversation happen, well, you know, I can't really say if it did or not. That is confirming it because
right.
If it didn't, like, imagine if he didn't have that conversation mm-hmm. with Trump, and he's saying right. I can't confirm or deny.
Right.
Trump would be at home like, what are you talking about? You can't get it. Didn't happen. Deny that it happened. So clearly, this is an admission that those sorts of conversations did happen. And when you combine that with a million other responses during these hearings, where they keep saying, I didn't feel pressured. Okay, forget the pressure. Did it happen? I can't confirm or deny. That's a strategy that they have come up with where we will just say we didn't feel pressured. It may have happened. It may have been unethical or illegal, but I didn't personally feel pressured. I like pressure situations. Then they're admitting what actually happened there. I mentioned during our production meeting, I forget her name, but it was I believe it was a female Democratic senator, said, did the White House give you any instruction on how to answer our questions? And was there a discussion of using executive privilege? And down the line, the four men said there was no discussion of executive privilege. 1, 2, 3, 4, sidestepping the first conversation, which is were you coached on how to answer these questions? Mm-hmm. And clearly they have been.
Yeah, it's a little disturbing because if Trump and his administration has absolutely nothing to worry about, if they have nothing to be fearful about, if their conduct has been completely legal and they haven't tried to meddle with this investigation, then why the lack of transparency? Why the refusal to answer questions? Mm-hmm. It's just incredibly strange to me. And it just keeps getting stranger. I mean, at the moment, we don't have, you know, this hardcore evidence that Russia, that he has these questionable ties to Russia, right? But the way that this is all kind of playing out makes people question him more and more, and it's not looking good for him. So
yeah, 100%. Now I do want to play a little bit more. In this next clip, you're going to have Angus King on a similar line of questioning.
Did you know when you wrote the memo that was used as the primary justification for firing Director Comey? That the administration would be using it as a primary justification?
Senator, as I know you're aware, I have, there are a number of documents associated with me that are in the public record. The memorandum I wrote concerning Director Comey is in the public record. The order appointing the special counsel is in the public record. The press release I issued accompanying that order is in the public record, and a written version of the statement that I delivered to.
Were you aware that it would be the primary justification for his firing?
Pardon me, Senator. 100 United States senators and 435 congressmen is in the public record. I answered many questions in the closed briefings of the 100 senators.
But you're not answering this question.
And as I explained in those briefings, Senator, I support Mr. McCabe on this. We have a special counsel who is investigating and now responsible for the Russian.
At this point, you filibuster better than most of my colleagues, so I'm going to move on to another question.
He does filibuster very well, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more in hour two. It's just crazy. Yeah,
and like we said, you can read between the lines, and you can discover quite a bit from this. And as you were talking about how this looks. I know that there are some people that still don't believe that there's anything there, and they will go to the end of days thinking that there's nothing there. But just think, okay, you have two possible worlds. Something is there to be discovered, something happened, or it didn't. The behavior that we've seen over the past 4 months does not make any sense if there's nothing there to be found. Trump and his cronies would not be going to these incredible, possibly illegal lengths to shut down and control this investigation if they could simply let it proceed and then nothing would come of it. But in particular, you might say, your response might be, okay, they're just worried that even if there's nothing there, the investigation existing will be a distraction. Mm-hmm. And that would be a fine counterpoint, except that their attempts to control the messaging and the narrative is the distraction. That is what's distracting from his agenda, if it exists. And they had to have caught on to that by now. So clearly, their behavior has some other explanation. The simplest one is that they're trying to avoid something being discovered.
Right, and for those who think this is just a huge distraction, or this is something that establishment Democrats have latched onto because they don't want to talk about policy. If you want to criticize Democrats for not talking about policy enough and focusing too much on Russia, I think that's a fair criticism. But I think it's also incredibly irresponsible and misguided to just pretend like Russia, like you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt that Russia is not an issue, let's not focus on it at all, even though there has been a slow and steady drip of some evidence, some indication that Russia did meddle in our elections, that there is obstruction of justice just based on Trump's very transparent behavior. Like, it's something that does need to be investigated. And it's just really interesting to me that especially liberals who are in favor of evidence, who want investigations, who want to make sure that, you know, things are kind of hashed out and put to rest before we move on. It's interesting that they want to move away from this and not focus on it at all. Yeah. You know, you can do, as Maxine Waters said, you can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, we got these 24-hour a day news networks. We produce a lot of videos here. I think that we can cover both.
Exactly.
Yeah. And look, what we're talking about here is obstruction of justice, and I've got a little bit more on that right now. The interesting thing about obstruction of justice is that it's illegal, and it's illegal whether they could find anything in this investigation or not. Even if there was nothing, he's free and clear. He cannot obstruct the FBI from conducting these investigations. And there are some people who would be willing to simply lay down, to provide no check on the illegal behavior of the president, simply because they're worried about some of the implications if it's found out. And that is frustrating. I wish that we could have some sort of united front on checking this president's excesses of power. Mm-hmm. But I do want to talk about the obstruction of justice, because you saw there Coates was testifying. Coates came up in something that was revealed yesterday, actually. This was being reported, I believe, by the Washington Post originally. Apparently, and this is coming from sources inside the administration, after a White House briefing on March 22nd, 2 days after Comey publicly confirmed the investigation into Trump's team in Russia, Trump requested that everyone present leave the room except Coates and CIA Director Mike Pompeo, just as he reportedly did before he asked Comey to drop the Flynn investigation. Then, according to this source, Trump started complaining about the FBI investigation and Comey's handling of it. He then asked Coates, quote, if he could intervene with Comey to get the Bureau to back off its focus on former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in its Russia probe. So there, he's talking to the Director of National Intelligence and seeing if maybe something could be done to shut down an FBI investigation of one of his associates. Again, you can't do that. That's not allowed. And clearly, Trump knew that it's not allowed. That's why he cleared the room before requesting it.
But John, the obstruction of justice or potential obstruction of justice is not the big story here. The big story is there are unnamed sources that are talking to the media, and we need to figure out who they are.
They need to be shut down. Yeah. Yes. Yes, they need to be unmasked. And so we're going to have a little bit now from James Comey. Obviously, James Comey is going to testify tomorrow. Barring some act of God, you know, Washington DC, the whole country is expecting that something might come out of this. Well, we don't know what the questions are that will be asked, and we don't know what Comey's responses will be, but we do have a pretty good idea of what he's going to say during his testimony, since the entire thing was leaked the day before. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure why that was the case, but we're going to read a little bit of it. Can't cover the whole thing, it's 7 pages, you can read it if you want. It's a very entertaining read. Here are a few sections. Comey says, I felt compelled to document my first conversation with the president-elect in a memo, referring perhaps to the memo that leaked a couple of weeks ago. To ensure accuracy, I began to type it on a laptop in an FBI vehicle outside Trump Tower the moment I walked out of the meeting. Creating written records immediately after one-on-one conversations with Mr. Trump was my practice from that point forward. This had not been my practice in the past. And this initial hurriedly typed down memo is another of the instances, it's concerning one of the instances in which Trump put pressure on him to back off the investigation into Flynn. And he said this, I thought this was very interesting. My instincts told me that the one-on-one setting, this is during the dinner we've talked about previously, and the pretense that this was our first discussion about my position meant the dinner was, at least in part, an effort to have me ask for my job and create some sort of patronage relationship. Because the setup made me uneasy, I added that I was not reliable in the way politicians use that word after Trump said, I want loyalty. But he said he could always count on me to tell the truth. I added that I was not on anybody's side politically, and I could not be counted on in the traditional political sense. A few moments later, the president said, I need loyalty, I expect loyalty. Interesting there. He goes on to say, and this is one of my favorite parts, it's just, only with Trump as president do we get memos by former heads of the FBI that say things like this. On the morning of March the 30th, the president called me at the FBI. He described the Russia investigation as, quote, a cloud that was impairing his ability to act on behalf of the country. He said he had nothing to do with Russia, had not been involved with hookers in Russia, and had always assumed he was being recorded when in Russia. He asked what we could do to lift the cloud.
But why?
I'm assuming why the hookers is a direct quote. I don't think Comey came up with that.
No, I don't think he would have said hookers. And that the fact that that was the only thing that Trump was concerned about is hilarious and ridiculous.
Hilarious and ridiculous, yet now I'm like, oh, he met with hookers in Russia, right? Like he keeps putting his foot in his mouth over and over again. Like, first of all, I don't care if you met with hookers in Russia, but for those who might care, now all of a sudden it planted a seed. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, then as you have to go and dispute the rest of the salacious claims, right?
Yes.
Like, you can't just say, I did not meet with hookers in Russia. The rest of that, maybe I did, but not the hookers.
That's a good point. Yeah, we heard you went to Russia and you slept with a hooker and then had like way too much cake. I didn't have cake.
Right.
That seems suspicious. Yeah.
So
and look, I get why. Devil's advocate, if none of it happened, you could be justifiably frustrated by people talking about it. That is entirely legitimate.
Which is
talking about it with the head of the FBI seems suspicious, though.
And also, look, if I was accused of something that I know I didn't do, I would be as transparent as possible,
right,
and I would cooperate as much as possible to prove that I wasn't involved
in
whatever it is, right? And he's doing the exact opposite of that. So if really there was no issue with Russia, yet he's going out of his way to obstruct justice, why? Like, what is going on with you? What is wrong with you? And that's the theme that we keep seeing play out again and again with Trump and his administration.
Now, I will say my prediction for tomorrow, I know a lot of people are hoping, so Comey's gonna testify, he's gonna he's just gonna lob bombs and it's gonna shake up the whole thing. And that's possible, but based on what we've read, it doesn't seem like that's gonna happen. Like, this is very interesting. I read this as clear obstruction of justice documented contemporaneously, backed up by multiple sources in the White House, which should be enough to theoretically impeach the guy, but we live in a crazy world, so it won't. I don't think that a lot of craziness is gonna come about naturally from Comey, but there is one wild card in this, and that is Donald Trump. So Robert Costa tweeted, I'm told by two White House sources that President Trump does not plan to put down Twitter on Thursday, may live tweet if he feels the need to respond.
Sounds like a great idea.
It sounds like a wonderful plan.
He is notorious for getting himself into trouble with the kinds of tweets he puts out there, right? And it's been part of the reason why he hasn't been able to implement some of his executive actions, something that I've brought up on the show multiple times, not able to implement the travel ban because he referred to it in a way that made it clear that it was discrimination against Muslims, which is unconstitutional. So, I mean, if you want to tweet, have at it, have fun.
And it just seems like it's an attempt to actively discredit James Comey as he's testifying. And I just think it's so interesting because there's a number of parallels between what Comey kind of identifies in his memos and like a sexual harassment case, right? Like this pressure, I don't want to be alone with this person. They make me very uncomfortable. And then the backlash to come from this open testimony. So it's just, it's bad. It's very bad. And the presentation, the public image of the president is terrible. And you would think that he would work a little bit harder to try to be transparent if he didn't in fact do any of these things. But it the fact that you have said that you might live tweet a hearing.
I don't think that's a great idea.
Maybe it's just a ploy to increase his Twitter followers. I don't know.
That's
people
possible.
Do that all the time.
That
sounds,
I hear he buys them. Half of them
that
are fake,
sounds
apparently.
Crazy. But every time anything happens, he's worried about whether or not he's getting enough shine. When Comey was introduced, he goes, this guy's getting more famous than me. This guy's a showboat. He doesn't like that he's getting attention that he seeks so badly. So afterwards, if he gets more eyes on his live Twitter feed than on the hearings, he's going to go, look who won the battle.
Which
is ridiculous, what he thinks. Because you are the president. Like if you want to make a formal statement at any given moment, you can do that. And it doesn't have to be vis-a-vis Twitter.
Yeah, it's short-sighted too. I don't even know if you can monetize your Twitter following when you're in prison. But I do like the analogy that you made to the sexual assault, like sort of thing. And he responds to both in the same way. I mean, after he fired Comey, he began attacking him, threatening him on Twitter. He's done the same to women who have claimed that he's sexually harassed and assaulted him. And that's what I think might shake things up. I mean, if he wants to distract, he knows if something bad has happened, I have to distract. But very often he distracts himself by shooting himself in the legs and door. Like he doesn't know what's gonna hurt him in the long run. And it's entirely possible that he will reveal something that the senators questioning Comey will see, because it's on Twitter, and then they will be able to ask Comey about it in real time. And if he starts attacking, if he starts threatening Comey, Comey might be pushed into revealing more than he otherwise would. I'm assuming that Comey is going to sort of go soft, slow roll this, because I think that he's working behind the scenes with Mueller. But that doesn't mean that theoretically Trump couldn't push him into revealing more than he otherwise might.
We hope.
We hope, and we'll see tomorrow, actually. We'll be covering it on the show tomorrow. With that, we should probably take our first break though. Let us know with hashtag TYT Live what you think about the stories we've already covered. When we come back, one of the most hated figures in the Trump White House could theoretically be on his way out. We will let you know who that is when we come back from this break. Welcome back to the first hour of the Young Turks, everybody. John, Ambria, and Anna. Before we get back to the news, I want to read some of the tweets that you guys have been sending in. Let's see. Gabby Marita says, hey Gabby, says Comey's testimony is anticipated almost as if it's the Super Bowl. What could he possibly testify that hasn't already been leaked? Yeah, I mean, well, his whole testimony has been leaked too. It could theoretically be edited, I guess, a little bit. But yeah, I expect that we know most of what he will reveal unless they trap him in some particularly clever question, I guess. Woke Poppy says, I feel like if the FBI finds Trump innocent, he will be like, no, I actually did it to get the attention he craves. Sad. Yeah. And Santos Huante says, cloudy with a chance of impeachment. I don't know. I still think that that's an incredibly unlikely outcome. Mm. More likely that he will simply be known to be breaking the law and will proceed in the way that
and it'll set a
many
precedent,
past presidents
right?
have.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the worst part about it. You yeah. know, it'll definitely set a certain lower standard of behavior for our presidents, and that's it. I mean, yeah. we'll just be complicit in it all.
I'm worried about that. That's one of the reasons we provide here yeah. as much oversight as we can. A couple notices, I guess, for you. There will be a post game today live for members after the Young Turks. Who is going to be on it with you?
Brett Ehrlich will join me again today. And also, I'm not sure who the third person is.
I think it might be Francis.
Francis, that's right. It is Francis. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yes.
Awesome. So that will be available to members. You can see that at theyoungturks.com. And if you're not already a member, I don't know what you're waiting for, but you can go to tytnetwork.com/join to get access, not just to today's postgame, but years and years of awesome postgames where we reveal things that we don't on the regular show, as well as you know, the past shows of various sorts, you know, things like a progressive that are only available to the members and more. By the way, for TYT old school fans, normally there would be one tonight. It unfortunately will not have a new show tonight. But next week there will be an old school with Ben Mankiewicz, Wes Clark Jr. and Mark Thompson. So that should be fun. Again, available to members. So consider if you're not already a member. With that, why don't we jump back into the news? Donald Trump's ongoing campaign to destroy anyone who shows him the least bit of loyalty continues with Jeff Sessions, who was one of his earliest and strongest defenders and supporters, now serves as his attorney general, and apparently in the past couple of months has repeatedly pissed Trump off. Trump's slow burning fury, it's being described as, apparently stems from Sessions' voluntary recusal from the sprawling federal investigation into Russian interference in the US election. So if you missed this originally a couple of months ago, after a lot of pressure, especially from the Senate, Jeff Sessions voluntarily said, I'm not going to be involved in anything having to do with the investigation. Now, it doesn't appear that that's actually true because he seems to have been involved in the decision to fire Comey in the first place. Right. But theoretically, he was not getting involved. Now, the president felt that that move was unnecessary. And anonymous sources, which Trump hates, close to the administration told news outlets that he blamed Sessions both for the expansion of the Russia probe and the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller to oversee it. Although remember, like Robert Mueller hasn't been, you know, on the job for 3 years. He came about specifically because of the incredibly suspicious way that they fired Comey.
That's right.
Right.
And Trump does not have Sessions to blame for that. Trump has Trump to blame for that. He always has a scapegoat for the complications he introduces into right. his own life. There would be no special counsel if he hadn't been acting in such an odd fashion, in such a, I would say, an authoritarian fashion, attempting to shut down investigations of him. And anyway, what did this culminate in? Well, apparently the attorney general's own frustration with the president due to both public and private sort of spats that they had prompted Sessions to offer his resignation just before Trump left on his first trip abroad as president in late May. That obviously wasn't accepted, but he did offer to leave the administration, opening the path for a new attorney general. So what is the current state of Jeff Sessions, who, as I alluded to before the break, one of the most hated people in the administration? Reporters asked Sean Spicer about the president's confidence in Sessions, and this is what happened.
Would you describe the president's level of confidence in the attorney general, Jeff Sessions?
I have not had a discussion with him about that.
Okay, last time you said that, there was a development.
I'm answering a question, which is I have not had that discussion with him.
So you can't say he has confidence in his attorney general?
I said I have not had a discussion with him on the question. I don't. If I haven't had a discussion with him about a subject, I tend not to speak about it.
Now, if that little smirk on Spicer's face didn't tell you the whole story, the idea that you have to check in every day to see if he still supports one of his employees would be right. odd. And as the reporter pointed out, this is almost exactly like what happened when they asked a question about James Comey not that long ago. Let's watch that clip.
Does the president still have confidence, full confidence in FBI Director James Comey?
I have no reason to believe. I haven't asked him. So I have not asked the president since the last time we spoke about this.
Yeah, same little smile. I didn't talk to him. I mean, I can't say it, but I didn't talk to him until, oh, he's fired. Oh, interesting. So Sessions might need to look for another job. We'll see.
It's good to see two white supremacists not getting along. So, I mean,
well, that's been a trend with white nationalists this year, right? Where they'll even try to host events together and then they fight amongst one another because they're clowns. And so we have a clown car in the White House, and this type of conflict is super obvious. It's super transparent. To be quite honest with you, before this story, I didn't realize that there was some conflict between Trump and Sessions. But Trump can turn on you at any minute, even given the fact that he pretends like he cares so much about loyalty. Yeah. He cares about loyalty toward him. He's not really loyal to anyone else around him. So if he sees anything you do as even a slight misstep, he'll be against you. And by the way, can we just quickly mention how incredibly bad Sean Spicer is at his job?
Oh.
And it's a difficult job, don't get me wrong, but he's so combative, and it's so obvious that, you know, either he's lying or he's trying to cover up for the president. And I know that's the job of the press secretary, let's keep it real. But he's just so bad at his job, it's amazing.
Yeah, he's stressed the fuck out.
I would not be there.
He's like, don't say anything Melissa McCarthy will use. Don't say anything Melissa McCarthy will use.
He's getting it from every way. So I don't feel bad for him. So
No, I don't feel bad for him either. I mean, no one's forcing him to do that job. Clearly he's still there because he, to some extent, wants to be there. But I feel like if I were in his position, I would make like that local news reporter who was pro marijuana and just be like, I quit this bitch, and like walk off, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, like, you should write a memoir.
Oh, maybe he's just sticking around as long as he can for that. One of the saddest things I read in the past month was, so Spicer goes on the trip that they go abroad, and Spicer had told Trump the only thing he wants is to meet the Pope. And so he goes in to meet the Pope, Trump does, and he's like, okay, I'll bring the wife, I'll bring the kids, Spicy, stay out there. He doesn't let him in. And as you say, it's their job to lie. Doesn't matter if it's for Obama or George W. or whatever. But, you know, some people are harder to defend.
Right.
And some people don't necessarily immediately undercut your defense at every opportunity. And so it is a difficult job. But to go back to Sessions, so they have this feud. He already said he'd be willing to leave. Now it's public that they've been feuding. And this is one of the sources that's an ally of Jeff Sessions in the administration, says Spicer's passive aggressive, quote, I haven't talked to the president dance, now as I'm refusing to defend our own attorney general. What an embarrassment. Would he answer the same way if he'd asked about Reince? I don't think so. I don't know, Reince isn't that popular, maybe he would. But it is, it's sort of a difficult thing to say, would it be good for him to be forced out? Because Sessions has a really disgusting past. I mean, he is old school American racism. His view of racial issues and also about what he wants to do in terms of the drug war, super problematic. I don't have any faith in him as the attorney general. In terms of this investigation though, if that's one of your priorities, he is at least ostensibly recused himself, which would not be the case of whoever replaced him. And that person would be sort of the person that Mueller would have to answer to. And so there's complications there.
Sure.
Let's figure out Trump's pattern now. See, right? If it's something he did, which you pointed out, something he does, then it's someone else's fault. This is like, I don't know how you guys have kids, but like, I have a 5-year-old kid and I've seen him around his friends. And sometimes if someone's in trouble, it's like, well, we've all seen it. When you were in elementary school, well, he did it. Well, you know, he did this happened first, and it's never your fault,
right?
Because he might get in trouble. Yeah. So the firing of Comey, he might get in trouble, and make sure we counteract this. Now with Jeff Sessions not recusing himself when he didn't want him to, it's your fault this is happening. It never is his fault. So as a child, this guy was never told, hey, you might want to take some responsibility for the things you do and think about it before you do them, and you'll avoid your problem.
Just think about them before you do them. I think that's one of his one of his flaws. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't have the ability to think about the ramifications of his actions before he takes them. So firing Comey, obviously, you know, that's not so great for optics, but he doesn't think about it. He doesn't think about what the ramifications will be for his tweets and when he's like ranting and raving about craziness. So he's just not much of a critical thinker.
Yeah.
And I think it's evident in the way that he's handled this entire Russia situation. I think it's evident in how he's handled pretty much everything, including healthcare. I mean, who would have known that it was so complicated?
Nobody would have known.
Nobody would have known.
Yeah.
Except if you were even a little intellectually curious, you would have known. But you're not. You're a right. clown.
Yeah. Yeah, and it might seem on the surface that this is just another one of those weird spats in the White House. But I mean, because of how important the Attorney General is, whether he stays or whether he goes is incredibly important for any number of different issues. So this is definitely something to be on the lookout for. And maybe Trump could come up with someone more reprehensible.
Of course.
I don't know who that would be necessarily. And so this might be an opportunity for a little bit of progress if he was forced out. Anyway, let's move on to something slightly different. An upcoming, actually, I think we're gonna reset that. There you go. Thanks. I didn't want to cut you off and then have to reset myself. An upcoming special election in Georgia, which is already known to be the most expensive congressional race in US history, is back in the news because of what happened at a debate last night. The question of the living wage came up. And in this video, you're going to see the Democrat, John Ossoff, and the Republican, Karen Handel, and their answers could not be more different. And perhaps more consequential for the race going forward. Let's watch.
Does either candidate support a minimum wage increase? Mr. Ossoff starts with you.
Yes, I do. The minimum wage should be a living wage. But look, if someone's working a 40-hour work week, they deserve the kind of standard of living that Americans expect. That's part of the American dream, and there are too many folks who are having trouble making ends meet.
Minimum wage.
This is an example of the fundamental difference between a liberal and a conservative. I do not support a livable wage. What I support is making sure that we have an economy that is robust with low taxes and less regulation so that those small businesses that would be dramatically hurt if you impose higher minimum wages on them are able to do what they do best, grow jobs and create good paying jobs for people in the 6th District.
They will be able to create good paying jobs, which I want to repeat, I don't care about.
Right. She thought she nailed it too at the end.
She did. What was amazing about that statement is it seemed very rehearsed. Meaning, I don't know if it was like part of a script that she rehearsed. I don't know if she realized what she said or if she misspoke. But it was a Freudian slip at the very least, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so symbolic of how some on the right, and honestly some on the left too, think when it comes to the issue of minimum wage and increasing it to an actual livable wage, yeah. Right? It's really an uphill battle for progressives who genuinely want that. And I love, you know, listening to arguments about wages because, you know, some people who are small business owners do bring up an interesting point about how it is difficult for them to maintain their business, to, you know, balance their business budget and still pay what, you know, the minimum wage is in a place like Los Angeles, for instance, where it's higher than most parts of the country. And, you know, we had that conversation, John, during a production meeting once. And, you know, you could help those small businesses if you are part of a government that genuinely cares about lifting them up and protecting them and supporting them. You can subsidize these small businesses as opposed to subsidizing big oil companies that don't need the subsidies,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree that saying I don't support a livable wage is to some extent a Freudian slip, but she did mean I don't support a living wage.
Right. Yeah.
And so she talks about, I don't think that we should be prioritizing how much a person makes. And then she goes on to talk about companies and, you know, their profits and their growth, which means she supports basically the equivalent of a livable wage for corporations,
sure.
Non-human
right.
entities.
Right.
She cares about that. She wants to make sure that they don't die on the street, but the individuals who actually work for them. Right. Hey, maybe if we help out the businesses someday, it'll help you individuals too.
Right.
And that is so perverse. I mean, what is morality if it's not grounded in concerns about people? If we're worried about whether some legal construct is doing well, then what is the purpose? What is our society for if we're not prioritizing people over corporations? And I would like to applaud her for her honesty and preceding it by saying, let's make clear the difference between right. a Democrat and a Republican. And that difference, very clear after watching that video.
Yes.
Yeah. I think to respond to both of you, I think it is rehearsed. I think it's the same script that we hear from most conservatives. It's this conflation of these code words with American values, right? Deregulation, more choice. what does that mean, right, on the ground? How do we implement that? And saying that small businesses will be harmed, right? Small businesses, what about people? But they don't, in fact, care about people. Capital is what they care about. Yeah. So, and I think she makes that very clear. Unfortunately, it's coded in this language that makes folks think, you know, conservatives really do care about my well-being, and they don't most often.
Right, and also their economic structure has failed us time and time again, right? It's not like, oh, it is a new idea that we haven't tried out yet. Why don't we cut taxes for these companies, and why don't we, you know, do away, or not do away, but let's not increase the minimum wage. Let's like basically leave things the way they are. But we have a case study. It's so obvious that it doesn't work. Wages have been stagnant. If you look specifically at military contractors like Boeing, Raytheon, those types of corporations, Naomi, who is one of our reporters, looked into how much they've profited over the last couple of years while simultaneously cutting tens of thousands of jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So them earning more revenue doesn't translate to them hiring more people. Exactly. It's actually quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. So her type of thinking is very harmful for the average American.
Yeah, yeah, and anybody who's even gone through one high school economics class knows that what stimulates, you know, hiring, it's not higher profits, it's demand for the product. You could, mm-hmm. like if you made a widget and you could make it for 10 bucks, but for some reason everybody's given you a million for it, you don't need to hire more people right. necessarily.
Right.
But they don't care about that because again, they pitch it as we're in favor of the mm-hmm. small businesses so that it'll help people, but that second part never actually materializes. No. They're there mm-hmm. for the first. Really fast, this is already being used by the Ossoff campaign. If you could bring up this tweet. Very clear message, I do not support a livable wage. And just in case you're wondering, Georgia's minimum wage is technically $5.15 an hour. Though in most cases, thankfully, we have the federal minimum wage, which is higher. If we didn't have that, you'd be making $5 an hour. There, the minimum living wage would be basically double what it is inside of Georgia. As I said, this is an incredibly expensive House race. Ossoff, the Democrat, has raised $8.3 million, and the DCCC has invested more than $5 million in the race. Outside conservative groups have spent $9 million since the start of the primary. And just in case you're wondering what the difference between Republicans and Democrats that aren't running for office is, nationwide, 55% of Republicans favor raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10, which is not necessarily living, but it is certainly better than what a lot of people around America are making.
Sure.
With that, we are going to take our second break. Let us know what you think about these stories. When we come back, we're going to reveal the investigation into some of the Trump charities and how they have personally profited off of childhood cancer. We'll be back in a few. Welcome back to the Young Turks, everybody. A little bit more time for you in this first hour before Anna takes over and drives us through the second hour. We've got some tweets from you I want to read. Admiral Marsden basically qualifies to be a part of one of our production meetings by sending in this tweet. Caring about her possible constituents, apparently she can't handle that. That's the sort of pun that we could come up with. Let's see. The Forgotten Arm says, if Handel still gets elected after saying she doesn't support a living wage, I'll have lost all faith in the voting public.
Well, you get ready.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you're not already there, but.
Yeah, right? I mean, Trump said he can grab a woman by the pussy.
Yeah, who is elected the choke-slamming guy?
The choke-slamming guy.
Yeah.
At some point, a Republican senator will set his rival on fire and win by 5 points.
It's like Gangs of New York.
Exactly. So we will see what happens with that. And there's some theories about why Spicer is still on the job. Basically, he's there just for his own amusement. And he is smiling a lot, so he doesn't seem to mind the job too much.
He's just trying to see if he can wait it out till the next Easter celebration so he can wear that costume again.
He just wants a chance.
That's the focus.
Yeah,
it's going to be Spicy's time to shine. Okay, let's jump into another important story. According to a report by Forbes, the Trumps apparently stole more than $1 million from a charity for kids with cancer. Now, in their defense, I guess, it was their charity they were robbing. But the money was still intended to go to kids with cancer. And I've always felt if you raise money for kids with cancer, you should give it to them and not spend it on portraits of yourself and stuff like that. But this is interesting. The work that was done by Forbes to uncover this, they reviewed filings from the Eric Trump Foundation and other charities. The Trump Organization received payments for its use. This is mostly golf courses, also restaurants. Part of more than $1.2 million that has no documented recipients past the Trump Organization. Golf charity experts say the listed expenses defy any reasonable cost justification for a one-day golf tournament. So basically, Eric Trump sets up this charity, to his credit, using Trump golf courses to raise money for kids with cancer. And a year or two goes by where everything seems above board. And yes, they have to spend some money to do the charity, but all charities have expenses. And the rest of the money goes to the kids with cancer. But things go awry. Now, along the way, we're going to explain why they go awry. But apparently, the Donald J. Trump Foundation used the Eric Trump Foundation to funnel $100,000 additionally in donations into revenue for the Trump Organization. And more than $500,000 was re-donated to other charities, many of which were connected to Trump family members or interests, including at least four groups that subsequently paid to hold golf tournaments at Trump courses. So they hold a golf course charity tournament. They raise a bunch of money, give it to other organizations which hold golf charity golf tournaments, which they then pay the Trump Organization to hold. So basically, here's the problem. It started off with Eric Trump getting to use these resources for free. After all, it's his family's. Then Donald Trump learned that the course was being used without charge and became upset. One of the marketing directors said, Mr. Trump had a cow. He flipped. He was like, we're donating all this stuff and there's no paper trail, no credit. And he went nuts. He said, I don't care if it's my son or not. Everybody gets billed.
That is insane.
So basically, they began taking in the donation money that they hadn't previously needed to pay for the course and keeping it. But what was interesting and far worse than just that is, in the first year, it supposedly cost $50,000 for this one-day tournament, which seems like a lot of money to me, but I don't run a charity, fine. Maybe it costs $50,000. The cost begins to balloon, going more than doubling, more than tripling within a couple of years. And now the money is being held by the Trump Organization, which means they're not just profiting off of this. Mm-hmm. They're ratcheting up the cost so that they can profit as much as possible before the money, the remaining money, I should say, actually goes to the charities.
So does this surprise anyone? Because if you hear the details of the story and you're surprised, then you haven't been paying attention. Trump claimed to have raised money for our veterans, and then it was disclosed that money didn't go toward the veterans he was raising the money for. Okay, red flag number one. Another red flag that, you know, came to light during the elections was the fact that he had this super questionable university operating in New York and other parts of the country that just exploited people who wanted better opportunities for themselves. So he scammed students and had to pay a $25 million settlement as a result of that. He has a history of exploiting disenfranchised people, exploiting powerless people just so he can make a buck. And here's a question. If you are a billionaire, right, and you're so wealthy that you feel the need to share how wealthy you are with the world on a daily basis and how successful you are, then why do you need to run these scam charities and these scam universities just to make a buck out of the neediest people? Yeah. Why?
Yeah, I'm not sure that this is criminal, but it feels like it is criminal to kind of redeploy, to mislead donors and then to redeploy that money to you and to, I guess, members of your board who are also on your payroll.
And probably in your family.
Yeah, so I mean, and this is our law and order candidate, right? So it feels like we're okay with certain crimes, right? Particularly his supporters. They like that he didn't pay taxes. They like that he's able to kind of skirt traditional norms, and as long as capital is what's to gain,
they consider him smart, right? But they didn't consider Hillary smart when she raised money in ways that they disagreed with, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this double standard, and you know, Hillary deserved the criticism that she got. He certainly deserves the criticism. Plus, 100 because he's 100 times worse in what he does. I mean, Hillary Clinton didn't go out of her way to exploit kids with cancer to make a buck. Yeah. But the Trump family certainly did.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is an area where, unless it comes out that eventually he was in on it, Eric Trump, who I'm not sure that he is strictly speaking human, to use his terminology, he doesn't think Democrats are human. He started up this charity and was originally trying to donate as much as possible. It was his father coming in and saying,
right,
you dummy. This isn't about the stupid kids with cancer. You're supposed to make a buck. And so, yes, some of his supporters are going to say, well, they still donated a lot of money to this charity. And that's true. They did donate the money. But they apparently did it so that they could skim the money off. Or at the very least, Donald Trump was doing it so he could make a little bit of profit. And
right,
personally, when I think of kids with cancer, I don't think about what's in it for me. But I don't have the resources that they do, I guess. Anyway, I don't know that that'll necessarily penetrate the consciousness of some of his strongest supporters, but it is kids with cancer. And yeah, maybe
they care. I mean,
that's
these conservatives the really do care about kids, right?
Pro-life.
Right? They're super pro-life.
It's also really icky that he used the money to then donate to other charities as if he was being
charitable.
This, yes, which is just disgusting.
Yeah, the guy who has a charity named after him supposedly has billions of dollars, and between 2009 and 2014 does not donate 25 cents to it even.
Right.
That's great. Look, maybe he's a stupid guy. Maybe he forgot he had the charity. There, that's devil's advocate. He's too dumb to know he has a charity. Anyway, so that's what's going on. We did have some more stories to get to. We'll probably bring them back tomorrow, including a good development in terms of Kansas's tax policy. It's a story we've been talking about for years here at TYT. This is the next step in it. We will get to that tomorrow. But thank you, Ambria.
This was fun.
Is there anywhere else that people can see your work? Other than the sociology department of UCLA.
Yeah, you can come take my sociology of gender class this summer as if I need more students. But no, just follow me on Twitter. I post my shows weekly.
Yep. Awesome.
Nice.
And Anna?
Yes, Brett Ehrlich and Francis Maxwell join me for hour two. We are going to do a number of great stories, including a viral video featuring Jerry Seinfeld and Kesha, which we couldn't use for copyright purposes, so we recreated it.
Oh, damn.
It's gotta
just
be good.
So we can cover
it. The original was good.
Yeah.
It was real good.
It was perfect.
Okay, so all that and more when we come back from this break.